Programming on NPR is supported by Northwest Airlines, offering service to more than 750 cities worldwide with Northwest Airlines and their global travel partners.
Good morning. Welcome to Mid-Morning. I'm Catherine Lanfer. Somewhere, your old high school civics teacher must be beaming. Only a few weeks ago, many Americans didn't give much thought to the Electoral College. But that was back in the days before we knew the terms butterfly ballot and hanging chad. These days, people aren't only talking about the Electoral College, they're debating whether we should keep it. A recent CNN Time magazine poll shows that 6 out of 10 Americans think the Electoral College should be replaced by the popular vote. When we last addressed that topic here on Mid-Morning, we spoke to an advocate for reform of the college. Today, we'll talk to someone who thinks we shouldn't be too hasty when it comes to change. We're joined today by David Lanoux. He's a professor and director of graduate studies in the political science department at Texas Tech University in Lubbock, Texas. He joins us by phone. Professor, thanks for being with us today. All right. I know that we have that professor there somewhere. Meanwhile, we know that you have lots of opinions on the Electoral College, and we're curious to know how you would have answered that CNN Time magazine poll. 6 out of 10 Americans say that they would like to go to the popular vote. As we already know, Senator-elect Hillary Clinton has said that she would like to draft legislation and that she'd be ready to hang up on that. Why don't you go ahead and join us? It's 1-800-242-2828, 1-800-242-2828. We're going to try to hook up with the professor again. David Lanoux, can you hear us?
Oh, yes, I can.
Well, I'm so happy to hear your voice. Thank you. Now, tell me, let's just go over one more time how the Electoral College works. I realize we've all sort of had a primer lately, but it never hurts to go over it one more time.
Okay, basically every state has a number of electoral votes equal to its number of House members plus its number of senators, which is always 2. And in every state except for 2, it's a winner-take-all system. So that means, for example, in Minnesota you have 10 electoral votes. Whichever candidate gets the most popular votes in Minnesota, in this case Al Gore, gets all 10 of Minnesota's electoral votes. At that point, we add up the electoral votes across the country, and the target number is 270, a majority of the Electoral College, and whichever candidate gets to 270 becomes president.
All right. And where do Al Gore and George W. Bush stand right now?
Well, that's, of course, a little unclear. Right now, we have the votes in, I guess, from every state except Oregon, New Mexico, and, of course, Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And as it stands now, Governor Bush and Vice President Gore are both short of the number. Oregon and New Mexico, for the moment anyway, don't seem to matter. Florida's 25 electoral votes would put either one of those two over the top.
And, in fact, even if they had New Mexico and Oregon, Florida is the state on which everything depends.
At the moment, that's correct, you know, barring recounts in other states.
All right. Now, has there been any talk, as with all this attention focused on the Electoral College, has there been any talk of maybe reforming it, of doing away with the winner-take-all approach in which you get all of a state's electoral votes?
Well, there have been a number of discussions about reforming the Electoral College. There are 2 states, Nebraska and Maine, which do not use the winner-take-all rule. In those 2 states, only 2 of the electoral votes are based on winner-take-all statewide, and then the others are given out on a winner-take-all basis in each congressional district in those states. And, of course, the more popular reform, as you mentioned earlier, is to eliminate the Electoral College altogether, go with the popular vote system, and I believe Senator-elect Clinton from New York has weighed in with that just the other day.
All right. Now, what about, I know that here in Minnesota, for instance, there's been some talk of trying to do something more akin to the Maine and Nebraska plan, a sort of proportional voting. Are we seeing any more waves for that?
Well, that remains to be seen. That will be done on a state-by-state basis. To get rid of the Electoral College entirely would take a constitutional amendment, and that would be very difficult to put together. However, to do it on a state-by-state basis certainly could be done at the level of the state legislature. To do it on a proportional basis is probably less likely. The more likely reform would be to do what Maine and Nebraska have done and do it on a congressional district basis.
Okay. Now, we often hear the college criticized as an elitist institution, that this is the result of 18th century thinking. How do you usually respond to that?
Well, I mean, first, I do agree that the original impetus for the Electoral College on the part of the framers of the Constitution was primarily elitist. They were concerned about the average person, whether the average person could make decisions for himself or herself, whether they would be governed by their passions rather than logic. And they did put a buffer between the people and their elected officials. Having said that, there are reasons for keeping the Electoral College which go beyond the reasons maybe that the framers originally thought.
What do you mean?
Well, I would say that basically there are three good reasons for keeping the Electoral College. The first is that it creates very clear rules, unambiguous rules, Florida notwithstanding, for sorting out winners and losers in a way that the popular vote wouldn't necessarily do. You could say, well...
I have to stop you right here. I mean, why are we in the mess that we're in? There's really no way to get rid of the ambiguity of a close vote.
Well, I think that's exactly the case, and people blame it on the Electoral College. Well, the fact is that the problems in Florida are not problems of the Electoral College. They're problems of the way ballots are put together and the way voters interpret ballots in a single state. I would say in defense of the Electoral College that if you had a popular vote system, right now the two candidates are about 0.2% apart in the popular vote, I could conceive of a national recount. So something that's happening in Florida happening in all 50 states, because every vote would be at issue here, and I could see something that's far more messed up than what we currently have.
On the other hand, doesn't the situation we're in now, if some people see it as an argument for keeping the Electoral College, it is sort of an argument against the winner-take-all mentality. I mean, if you have a popular vote that statistically works out into a tie, that's patently undecidable because it's so, the margin of error is so razor sharp, then why have all of the votes go to an election we've decided we really can't call?
Well, first of all, I mean, the Electoral College vote is going to be virtually a tie in the end as well. So I'm not sure that that's as big an issue. But I think the reason to keep the winner-take-all system goes beyond the circumstances of this particular election.
Mm-hmm.
The thing about the winner-take-all system is that it forces candidates to build state-by-state majorities in the Electoral College, and it means that candidates will address the concerns of all regions of the country and not just those areas where they have their greatest support or those areas that have the greatest population. If you look at some of the states that got attention this year, West Virginia, Iowa, New Hampshire, Tennessee, Arkansas, Washington, to some extent Minnesota, these are states that would not nearly get the attention that they did if you had a popular vote system.
We are talking to David Lanoux. He's a professor and director of graduate studies in the political science department at Texas Tech University in Lubbock, Texas. 6 out of 10 Americans told pollsters for CNN and Time magazine that they would like to switch from the Electoral College to the popular vote. But not everyone thinks we should be so hasty. We'd like to know what sort of reforms or no reform you would like to see with the Electoral College. It's 651-227-6000 if you're in the Twin Cities. 651-227-6000. Otherwise, it's 1-800-242-2828. 1-800-242-2828. Now, Professor Lanoux, you were saying that there were three reasons, and we interrupted you mid-reason, so why don't you continue with your defense of the college?
Okay, the second reason is the one I just named, that it mm-hmm. does require candidates to address the concerns of all regions of the country and not just run up the score in one or two regions. And the third is that the Electoral College has a moderating influence, which I personally think is a good thing. A liberal candidate can't just maximize the vote in California or the Northeast. A conservative candidate can't just maximize the vote in the South or Rocky Mountain states. Both Bush and Gore had to go all over the country, had to appeal to the issues of places like Michigan and West Virginia and Arkansas, and I don't think that's a bad thing.
Now, what about those who would argue that, in fact, because of the Electoral College, there are some states that get more attention than they deserve? California, Florida, traditionally Pennsylvania, and New York as well.
Well, I think what you're going to find is no matter what system you have, some states and some areas are going to get more attention. Now, as it happens, the ironic thing this time is that the big states largely did not get that much attention. California was pretty much written off for Gore until the very end. New York got very little attention. Obviously, down here in Texas, we barely knew there was a campaign in that everybody knew that George Bush was going to win the state. So it cuts either way. I think if you had a popular vote system, the areas that got attention would be the high population areas, the large cities and the suburbs. I don't think you can construct a system where there aren't some states that end up with more attention than others.
What pitfalls do you think there are in going directly with a popular vote?
Well, I think that people talk about how the popular vote is more democratic, and I think that's kind of a slippery concept. Take, for example, the current election. You have Governor Bush. Let's say Governor Bush wins, and we don't know that yet. But let's say he does. You have a candidate who got almost 50% of the vote, came in second place by an eyelash, got the majority of or the plurality of votes in 30 out of 50 states. And then you can compare that to the state of Minnesota. And I don't presume to tell Minnesotans how to run their elections, and that's not my point here. But you have a governor who basically came in first place by an eyelash and was rejected by roughly two-thirds of the voters in the state. He only got 37% of the vote in Minnesota. Again, I'm not saying that Governor Ventura is not legitimate. I'm saying that the concept of what is more democratic and less democratic is a lot more slippery than people think.
Let's go to Jeff in Brooklyn Center. Jeff, welcome to Mid-Morning.
Good morning.
Hi.
Always glad to hear. Been learning a lot about the Electoral College the past few days, listening to NPR. And I think what I would like to see is a modified Electoral College, sort of on the model of Maine, with each congressional district having an elector who votes according to the popular vote of his or her district. And then the two corresponding to the senatorial would vote for the popular vote, the winner of the popular vote for statewide.
All right. Professor, how does that sound?
Well, I guess I have two responses to that. Mm-hmm. First of all is that we move the winner-take-all problem, if one considers that a problem, simply we move it from the state level to the district level. And the second thing is I think by moving in that direction, you do take away to some extent the requirement that candidates have to build a majority state by state by state and gain the legitimacy that comes from building a truly national coalition.
We're going to go to Alice. She's calling us from Rosemont. Alice, welcome to Mid-Morning.
Yes, hi. As so much of what he said, I would just like to reiterate because I definitely am against doing away with the constitutional right that we have that our forefathers and framers of the Constitution gave us. I do believe that if we had a popular vote, that the high population areas would get all the attention, and those of us even here in Minnesota would not be acknowledged at all with our concerns.
Alice, how is that different from the way this election was or the election before then?
Well, I enjoyed the attention that we received by both candidates. I mean, they were coming here a lot, and I think that's important because even though sometimes they didn't know where they were, especially Gore seemed very confused, I think it's important, though, that they reach out and find out what people are concerned about in various areas of the United States. And so the elections won't be controlled by the most populous states, you know. And frankly, I used to live in Florida, and I know it's a diverse population of people, but I still don't want Florida, New York, and California deciding the elections for us all. And remember, too, that 30 out of the 50 states did go for Bush. And I just think we should stick with what we have. It has worked for years. This is just kind of an anomaly, and I think it will be sorted out. And I do believe that President Bush will be the winner, and I hope so.
All right. Well,
we
thank
need
you.
A change.
All right. Thank,
thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Bye.
Professor, feel free to jump in.
Okay. I agree with the caller's assessment of what would happen in Minnesota. I mean, the state did get a fair amount of attention this time because it became late in the game kind of a swing state. I would think in a popular vote system, again, you would have candidates who would go to the major population areas, and I imagine the Twin Cities would get a little bit of attention, but certainly not to the degree they got this time.
Talk for a minute about, there are several different scenarios that are floating around, one of which is when the Electoral College meets in December 18th, when they get together to vote, they don't necessarily have to include Florida electors in their ranks. How does that work?
That's what I understand. Now, there is actually some controversy over that. Nobody's quite sure, and I imagine if Florida is still undecided by December 18th, the Electoral College voting day, that the courts will be asked to step into it. But supposedly the way it works is that those electors who have been certified are the ones who then cast votes, and if the Florida electors are not certified, then they simply don't cast their votes. And all the Constitution says is that a majority of electors have to be have to vote for the winning candidate, and it would simply be a majority of the 538 minus Florida's 25.
All right, and let's do the reality check on that scenario.
In terms of who would win?
No, in terms of how conceivable is it? I can't help but think that people would be baying, they'd be howling for blood if the Florida electors couldn't vote.
I would be very, very surprised if that happened. I don't think the courts would stand for it. I don't think the state of Florida would stand for it. My understanding is the Secretary of State of Florida this morning said that the state has to conduct all of its recounts by the end of the day tomorrow. Now, that will be challenged, of course, in court, but I don't think Florida would stand for that outcome.
We're going to go to Paul. He's calling us from St. Paul.
Good morning, Catherine. How are you?
All right. Hi.
Catherine, I wanted to comment on the distortion caused by the Electoral College. If you look, for example, at two states, North Dakota and California, North Dakota has about 600,000 people. California has roughly 50 times as many people, over 30 million citizens in California. And yet North Dakota has three full electoral votes compared to just 54 in California. That's a ratio of 18 to 1. Rather than 51, which is a population basis. And it has the effect of distorting things by making a North Dakotan's vote using the Electoral College ultimately three times as powerful as the same vote cast by a Californian. Now, there seems to be a constitutional inconsistency. The Supreme Court said some decades ago that in America we have a one-man, one-vote system, or as we would now put it, one-person, one-vote. How do we rectify that that constitutional inconsistency by making the individual's vote every bit as powerful regardless of where one lives?
Well, one thing I would say, and I don't mean to sound glib about it, is that the Constitution can never really be unconstitutional. The Electoral College is not the only mechanism we have that violates the one-person, one-vote rule. North Dakota also has two senators, the exact number that California has, which is a distortion far above the distortion of the Electoral College. So in that sense, I don't think the Supreme Court would make that ruling.
Well, that's two wrongs making a right, Professor. It may not be unconstitutional, but it is clearly inconsistent, and it is essentially un-American in that the one person, one vote is what we've come to rely on, and this election points up the fact that that is utterly fraudulent in American politics and electoral behavior today.
Would you prefer to get rid of the Senate as well?
Absolutely.
Okay. I tend to support the original Federalist notion of this country that the states are important in and of themselves, and that the smaller states do require some protection if they're going to remain independent, viable entities from being overrun by the larger states and the wills of the larger states.
Yeah, but we're really a nation of individuals more than we are a nation of states. We were a nation of states 200 and some years ago. That is an historical anomaly. In the year 2000 in America, surely the voice of an individual is paramount, not the voice of an archaic state structure that dates back to the 1700s.
All right. Thank you, Paul. I thank you for your call. We're going to move on to Frank. He's calling us from Superior, Wisconsin. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Oh, good morning. The point that I wanted to make was that surely the objective is to find a system that makes every vote count. And the suggestion that I would have is that you move to a popular vote, and secondly, you then move to an STV system, or single transferable vote.
Well, what the heck? Whoa, got to stop you there, Frank. What the heck is that?
I'm glad to explain that. What you do is you vote 1, 2, 3. And as candidates...
Instant runoff? Is that what you're talking about?
Well, yes, that's one way of describing it, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And that eliminates the argument that your contributor has about Governor Ventura, although I still think it's quite possible that he would have been elected under that system, but at least he would know, as would everybody else, whether he had 50% support. And I do think that some of the arguments that I've heard about the reasons why one doesn't have a popular vote are quite spurious. I mean, the argument that because it's difficult, the fact that Florida seems to have fairly incompetent people counting votes is no reason for not having a system which is capable of counting the votes. That's a judgment on their administrative abilities rather than anything else. And to suggest that if necessary the country couldn't go to a national recount, I find quite odd. It just seems to suggest that people are incapable of organizing an effective vote. And as I understand it, certainly in Minnesota and Wisconsin, the administration is quite capable of organizing efficient recounts. And I don't see why that shouldn't be the case everywhere.
All right. Frank, let's let the professor have a chance to respond here.
Well, I don't want to sound like a broken record here. I'm familiar with the STV system, and I suppose it's better than a simple plurality system. I agree with the caller on that. But it still doesn't address my concern about the requirement in a diverse country such as ours for candidates to get their majorities and their legitimacy by showing support all over the country and not just being able to run up the score in certain regions.
Let's go to Sharon in Minneapolis. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Good morning.
Hi, Sharon.
Hi. I just wanted to put my vote in for an altered or moderated electoral college vote similar to what Maine has. And the reason that I think that that would be the best choice or something similar to that is because if we went with a straight popular vote, I believe our rural areas and our farmers would virtually have no voice at all. And I would hate to see the condition of this country after a couple of presidential elections where all the candidates were concerned about was reaching out to major metropolitan areas and their concerns. I think that electoral college vote gives a little more meat to the votes of our farmers and rural areas in this country, and that just as certain minority groups sometimes need a little extra boost and a little extra support to bring them up to a position of equality, I think we need to look at our rural areas in the same way. And I think the fact that districts could be represented by their individual electoral college votes is a much fairer way of approaching it, because you look at a state like Minnesota, the Minneapolis-St. Paul metro area is what carried the election, and the whole outstate area, you know, virtually had no voice because all the electoral college votes went Democratic, as it has for as many elections as I can remember. And I think the fact that the senatorial votes, electoral college votes, would go to the popular vote would be enough of an incentive for the candidates to visit each state, you know, if each state is equal in that respect.
Sharon, you confused me when you mentioned the Senate. I'm not sure what you mean.
Well, the electoral college votes that are in conjunction with the Senate, the two senators for each state, those went to the popular vote of the state, you know, as they do in Maine.
Mm-hmm.
That would give the incentive to the candidates to go across the board and reach out to all states. But I think what you'd find in a situation like this is that the candidates would be they would be approaching groups of people, like farmers, small town groups, major metropolitan groups, rather than state to state to state. They'd be addressing, you know, urban concerns. They'd be addressing rural concerns.
Well, Sharon, let's let the professor have a chance to respond here. And thanks for your call.
Yeah, I would say that I'm less troubled by moving to the Maine-Nebraska model than I am by most other reforms. Having said that, I think we should note that since Maine and Nebraska have been doing this, to my knowledge, their vote has never been split. It's always gone winner-take-all, even by that method. Now, obviously, in states that are larger and more diverse, like Minnesota or certainly California, that wouldn't necessarily be the case. But I would give one word of caution. Some states may adopt this, others may not. the states that adopt this method, assuming that not all states do, are going to be relatively disadvantaged. If Minnesota splits their electoral vote up and California keeps their winner-take-all system, for example, the states with winner-take-all are going to be far more valuable as a whole and I think are going to get more attention.
We are talking to David Lanoux. He's a professor and director of graduate studies in the political science department at Texas Tech University in Lubbock, Texas. We would like you to join our conversation about the Electoral College. It's 1-800-242-2828. 1-800-242-2828. If you're in the Twin Cities, it's 651-227-6000. 651-227-6000. I'm Catherine Lanfer. You're listening to Mid-Morning. We're going to turn now to Greta Cunningham, who has all of the Electoral College votes to give us the latest.
Yes, I do. Thanks, Catherine. Good morning. Florida's top election official has handed a setback to Al Gore. She says the deadline of tomorrow afternoon for counties to certify their results from last week's election won't be extended. Democrats argue that the hand recounts they've requested can't all be completed by then. A sample hand count in one county over the weekend suggested the possibility that Al Gore could pick up some votes. The battle over the Florida recounts continues on another front. In a Miami courtroom, lawyers for George W. Bush's campaign will be trying to put a stop to the manual recounts that are already underway in some areas. They say the recounts are unconstitutional. The Gore camp says they're proper under Florida law. The bodies of about 50 victims of the weekend cable car disaster in Austria have been removed, and more than 100 other victims are still there. The bodies are being taken to a morgue in Salzburg, where forensic experts will be doing DNA tests to help identify them. That's a process that could take weeks. No surprises from today's OPEC meeting. The oil cartel meeting in Austria decided not to increase its production for now. The decision came with a warning for OPEC members that supply could soon be bigger than demand. In regional news, U.S. Energy Secretary Bill Richardson and U.S. Interior Secretary Bruce Babbitt are in Minnesota today to speak to tribal leaders attending the National Congress of American Indians. Leaders from more than 300 tribes will gather in St. Paul this week for the event. The Congress is the oldest and largest organization of tribal nations. Officials say roads in southern Minnesota are slippery, and they're warning drivers to slow down this morning. Some parts of Minnesota, mainly in the west, got their first real storm of the season over the weekend. In northern Minnesota, more than 5 inches of snow fell yesterday at Duluth International Airport. The forecast for Minnesota today has a winter weather advisory in effect for east central and northeastern Minnesota today. Periods of light snow are in the forecast. Additional accumulations of 3 to 4 inches are possible in east central and northeastern Minnesota. Highs today will range from 28 in the northwest to 38 in the southeast. At this hour, some light snow reported throughout the region. Rochester reports some snow and 27 degrees. It's snowing a bit in Duluth and 30 degrees. And in the Twin Cities, scattered light snow showers, a temperature of 30. Catherine, that's a look at the latest news.
Programming on Minnesota Public Radio is supported by Care 11, host of Care11.com. 24-hour access to updated weather, radar, news, and traffic information. Care11.com.
Hello, I'm Bill Klang, president of NPR. Over the years, you've told us we've become the best source of radio for adult audiences. We tell you about important issues. We do it with depth, balance, integrity, and accuracy. And many of you tell us that you learn from our broadcasts, that you stay tuned longer than planned, and that you make daily decisions from what you hear. When I started with NPR, there was no public radio. We built it, and we built it with the support of listeners. People trusted us, invested in us, and now you hear the result of that each day. We're proud of those of you who became early supporters. Together we've created something so significant that it would be hard to imagine not having it. This has been a good year for many of you, and I hope you'll make it a priority to become a supporter of public radio during this year's membership drive. We need your support. We've got even more opportunities and challenges than ever. Consider the true value of NPR and become a member or increase your membership level this year. Thanks.
Support for this programming comes from the members of Minnesota Public Radio. Thank you. I'm Catherine Lanfer. You're listening to Mid-Morning. Want to remind you that we are continuing our coverage of this continuing election. In the second half of Mid-Morning, a few minutes after 10, we'll be talking about the media and how they have covered the election flip-flop on election night and also this unending campaign and election. Let us know what you think. We're talking right now about possible reforms to the Electoral College. What reforms would you like to see to media coverage of elections? Make sure you join us for that. Meanwhile, we're continuing our conversation with David Leneau. He's a professor and director of graduate studies in the political science department at Texas Tech University in Lubbock, Texas. He's joining us by phone. We'd like you to do the same. It's 1-800-242-2828. 1-800-242-2828. If you're in the Twin Cities, it's 651-227-6000. 651-227-6000. Professor, let's talk for a minute about third-party candidates. We have so many Americans now, a majority, according to the CNN Time poll, that want to change the Electoral College. They want to abolish it, in fact, and go directly to popular vote. What would that do to, say, third parties?
Well, I think that it would probably weaken third parties even more than they are now, because one of the arguments that you can make if you're a third party is that by getting enough of the popular vote in the state, you might be able to deprive one candidate or another of that state, and that might send the message to one of the major parties that your issues ought to get a little more attention. In a popular vote system, someone like Ralph Nader would simply be overwhelmed by the totality of the votes and would presumably have much less of an appeal for that reason.
So then is there any system that actually makes it easier for third parties? Because certainly you can't argue that the Electoral College makes it easy for third parties to flourish.
Oh, no, certainly not. I mean, there's no winner-take-all system that's going to make it good for third parties. And from the point of view of third parties, of course, a national vote, a plurality vote, or a majority vote is also a winner-take-all system. If Ralph Nader gets 4%, 5%, 10%, he still does not get the presidency.
Let's go to John in Bloomington. John, welcome to Mid-Morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Uh-huh.
First, I want to say I am a advocate for the Electoral College and would be willing to look at a modification, but my question was that if you look at the way our government is set up, there's a balance of power amongst the government. Isn't that the same in what the Electoral College is trying to do, is balance the power? And I'd hate to have, again, I just reiterate what other callers have said, I'd hate to have, you know, a mass of 5-6 cities determining who the president is and not the rest of the country. I'll wait and listen.
All right. And let me just tag something onto that, Professor, because often what you hear is that there was an attempt for a balance of power, but it was rather an elitist attempt, and some of it had to do with making sure that the power resided in the hands of a very small amount of people.
Well, I mean, the framers of the Constitution were certainly elitists. As I say, there's no question about that. On the other hand, they were also very concerned with the workings of government internally, and one of the things they were persuaded of was that by dispersing power as much as possible, whether it was between branches of government or between the various states, by dispersing power and setting it against itself, you would have the least opportunity for small factions, as Madison called them, to have undue influence.
What about those assertions that you can read and that seem to linger, that this had something to do with slavery, that there was some fear that the southern states, because they had more population, albeit much of it disenfranchised. Talk for a minute about the connection that so many people make between the founding of the Electoral College and slavery.
Well, the issue of slavery, of course, found its way into all sorts of aspects of constitutional planning, right down to the fact that in one of the most distasteful compromises for purposes of elections, they made slaves, although they had no right to vote, count as 3/5 of a person. And I think part of what happened with the Electoral College is that it was a concern by all states, both northern and southern, that they wanted to make sure that candidates couldn't run up majorities in one region of the country and therefore tilt the balance of power unduly. And certainly the northern states were concerned about that with respect to the South, especially with the slave vote being counted in some sense toward reapportionment and toward congressional representation. But also it was a concern among the southern states.
All right, let's go to Adam in Maple Grove. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Yes, I'm calling because I'm very surprised that it seems as though the general public considers the Electoral College system very bizarre, because to me it seems as though it's not unique to our voting system, but rather if we look, for example, to athletics, no one questions the viability of a team that wins the series based on the number of games won versus the total points scored during those games. For example, a World Series victor, no one would question the victor, even if they score fewer runs but win more games out of the series. That's my comment.
Okay. Thanks, Adam. Professor?
Well, I guess a couple things. I mean, I generally agree with the caller, although obviously Joe Torre is not going to determine whether abortion rights continue or anything like that. I think that the point that the caller makes, I think, is very germane, is that there really is no system where you will not have rules that are controversial. Even if you say, let's use the popular vote, do you mean any popular vote, no matter any plurality, no matter how small? If so, then that's a rule that people are going to have trouble with, because you're going to have people elected sometimes with significantly less than majority vote. Or you could ask, okay, should we have a runoff election if nobody gets to 50%? Well, that's another rule that's controversial. If you have a runoff election, we know from experience that's going to be a low turnout election. Low turnout elections have very different groups of people voting, and that's going to skew the system. So there really is no system that's not going to require some kind of rules that are going to be controversial.
We're going to go to Lori in Shoreview. Welcome to Mid-Morning, Lori.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
My question is, I wonder if you could answer, in states where the electors are not required to vote based on the popular vote, where they can basically vote however they want to, why do we bother having elections in those states?
Well, basically the way it works is that under the original Constitution, electors were not bound to the vote in the state. And in many states, that's still the case. In other states, they have laws that prohibit electors from being what we call faithless, from voting against the will of the state. Having said that, as a practical matter, the slate of electors who are chosen by the Republican and Democratic parties are people who are the strongest, most loyal supporters. And that means that the likelihood is extremely high that when they go to cast their electoral votes, they will cast them the way that the state has instructed them to do.
All right, let's go to Richard in Minneapolis. Richard, welcome to Mid-Morning. Hi, Richard. All right, we'll come back to Richard in a minute. Professor, this election obviously is highlights a number of things about our system, but talk for a minute about how this particular election highlights the complications of having both a popular and an electoral vote.
Well, certainly it heightens public confusion for one thing, which is never good, and I think it leaves a lot of the public a little bit confused, which is why I think shows like this are a positive thing. People end up thinking, well, if Al Gore won the vote, how come he's not president? Does that mean my vote doesn't really count? And then we have to explain how the popular vote translates into the electoral vote. But you don't want to take too many lessons from the most bizarre election in over 100 years. The fact is that under a popular or an electoral vote system, every so often we're going to come up with an election where the country is so close, is so narrowly split, that it's really going to be unique. It's going to open up a lot of problems, but they're not really problems that we should expect from year to year.
Let's go to Richard in Minneapolis. We'll try him again. Richard, welcome to Mid-Morning.
Hello. I'm not Richard in Minneapolis, but I'll talk anyway.
Well, that's all right. Why don't you tell us your name and where you're from?
I'm John in Duluth.
Okay, hi.
I think this is very simple. The question is this. Should we have direct democracy, one person, one vote, or should we have the states having partial power in the presidential elections? It's a philosophical issue. Reasonable people can differ on it. I think that having one person, one vote is a fundamental tenet of democracy, and that's how things should be. You know, people talk about the practical effects of changing things, but this kind of direct democracy works in almost all Western countries, and it would work fine here too. And I just think that the Electoral College is an anachronism, and it should be abolished.
Well, when you say one person, one vote, would you be satisfied with an outcome where the winner received, let's say, 35, 36% of the vote?
Well, I mean, we can talk about the details. I mean, that could be arranged constitutionally, whether you could have a runoff system. I personally favor a runoff system as opposed to having, for example, what happened in 92 where Clinton only got 43% of the popular vote. But I think either situation would be preferable to the situation we have now where some people are essentially disenfranchised. For example, I'm a Republican. I live in Minnesota. My vote doesn't matter. If you are a Democrat and you live in Wyoming, because of an accident of geography, the fact that most of your neighbors are almost all your neighbors are Republican, you are disenfranchised. I think that simply violates
John, I'm going to interject here. You say your vote doesn't matter. It's almost as if in many of the conversations we've heard about this over the past few days, if your vote doesn't win, it doesn't matter. But that's surely not what we're talking about.
No, no. My vote doesn't matter because, well,
Seriously, examine that statement. What do you mean your vote doesn't matter?
Because of, well, let's just change it. For example, a state that goes highly Republican, let's say Utah. Utah wins something like 67% Republican. If you're a Democrat who happens to live in Utah, your vote doesn't matter because all the electoral votes, no matter what you do, are going to go to the Republicans. I think that's wrong.
I get back to my original point. It sounds like what we're saying is unless your vote somehow wins, then it doesn't matter.
No, your vote is not counted because your vote, even though it's a vote for the Democrats, is not reflected in any sense in the Electoral College. For example, however, if you had a direct popular vote, yours would be one of the 49 million votes that went to Gore. That's what I'm saying.
Let's turn to the professor. David Lanoux.
I have a little trouble with the argument, I guess, too, because I obviously the popular vote translates into the electoral vote, so your vote in that sense does matter. Now, it may not translate the way you want it to, but by the same token, if you voted for Senator Grahams, the fact that he lost, does that mean that your vote didn't count? I think your vote clearly counted. You were simply on the losing side, and that would hold as well for Democrats in Utah. If we went by a popular vote system without a runoff and you voted for George W. Bush, you would have lost. It doesn't mean your vote doesn't count. It simply means that you weren't part of the winning majority.
What do you make of that CNN Time Magazine poll that we mentioned in the introduction that shows that 6 out of 10 Americans say it's time to switch to a direct popular vote?
Well, I think that the arguments against the Electoral College are the easiest to conjure up to understand the idea that this violates the one-person, one-vote notion. I don't think there's really been much of an effort by proponents of the Electoral College to really make the case for why the Electoral College is a valuable institution, because for 112 years, it really hasn't mattered because the Electoral College vote has been, or the winner has been the same as the popular vote winner.
And all of the different court actions that we're waiting for today, how will they, what should we be looking out for over the next few days?
Well, the first question will be the challenge that the Democrats make of the Secretary of State in Florida, of her ruling that all the recounts have to be done by the end of the day tomorrow. If that ruling stands, there's no way that they can do a hand count of every ballot in Palm Beach County or certainly Dade and Broward counties. The second question would be the ruling that should come sometime today from Governor Bush's people, which is asking a federal judge to stop the recount altogether. So those are the first two court challenges to look to. And then as we go down the line, there will be the challenge by the voters in Palm Beach County who say that they were disenfranchised by the way that the ballot was constructed. They say it was a violation of Florida election statutes, and we'll see how the judge rules on that.
All right. And we know that the electors meet on December 18th. So is it possible that this won't be settled by then?
Well, it's certainly possible. As I said before, I very, very much doubt it. I don't think that the courts will allow this to drag on past the date where the electors meet. And I think the state of Florida, which certainly doesn't want to be disenfranchised, will do everything in its power to make sure that there's some decision by that time.
Let's go to Julie in Duluth. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Hi. I would like the professor to address the issue of Hillary Clinton has said she'd co-sponsor legislation to get rid of the Electoral College. Is this going to become a partisan issue?
Well, I mean, I think in the short term it may end up being a partisan issue simply because the Democrats, if they lose, will feel like the aggrieved party since their candidate got the most votes. Now, obviously, what Senator-elect Clinton is doing is in the interests of the state she's going to represent because the large states and with large metropolitan areas, I think, would be advantaged by using the popular vote system. So she's certainly doing her job representing the state of New York. The other thing that I would point out to people who want to get rid of the Electoral College, including Mrs. Clinton, is that it's not all that easy to do it. To get rid of it entirely would take a constitutional amendment, and that requires a two-thirds vote of both houses of Congress and then ratification by three-quarters of all states. That's very, very difficult to do.
We're going to go to Carrie in St. Paul. Carrie, welcome to Mid-Morning.
Hello.
Hi, Carrie.
Hi. I wanted to say that I am a new citizen to the United States. I became a citizen in 1998, and I voted in my first federal election this past month, and that I will accept however it comes out in Florida. However, I am shocked at how many Americans do not understand your own political system, and you are constantly on the radio telling people how it works. And all the people who come here, we all have to learn how it works, and I could have answered any of the questions related to the governmental system, and this is the system you have in place, and I'm shocked.
Well, no, Carrie, I obviously we should book you as a guest.
I would also like to make one other comment. I think that you should have standardized federal election equipment more than worrying about electoral college. If you had, I understand that each state has their own state's rights and may object to having the cost of having to have equipment, but to participate at a federal level, it seems to me that is the largest problem that you are running into.
That's an interesting point. Professor, yeah. Could you respond to that?
I'm sympathetic toward her point because I think it would save a lot of inconvenience if we had the best technology. I know that I just read a county in California, Riverside County, is using computer terminals which automatically prevent you from voting for more than one person and make it very clear the person for whom you voted. That would be nice if we could have that nationwide. The problem is those terminals, just to rent them, cost something like, I think it was $2,500 a unit. And for some states and localities, that would be a very prohibitive expense. I don't think, as much as we might want it, that the federal government would have any authority to come in and tell the states how to conduct their elections, however.
We're going to go to Michael in Minneapolis. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Hello.
Hello, Michael.
Hi, how you doing? I'm on hold. I didn't realize I was getting ready to come on.
There you are.
I just had a quick question that relates to what you said earlier on about elitism and also about democracy and the founding fathers being worried about that and not really trusting the average citizen. I mean, my understanding in reading the Federalist Papers is that they had a different concern, and that was that people should not be judges in an issue in which they were a party, in which they had interests. And so that the reason we have the system we do that has a lot of representation was so that people would not be judging in an issue in which they were a party. So it's not that they didn't trust everybody, but that they were always trying to come up with a system that allowed for a disinterested judgment on an issue.
All right.
I was wondering if the professor could comment on that.
David Lanoux?
Well, I mean, I don't disagree with the caller that the reasons for the things the framers did and the institutions they set up were certainly more complicated. And it's a bit facile to just say, as I suppose I did, that it was simply a matter of elitism. Of course, the framers were concerned with the structures of government and trying to, as I say, limit the powers of faction. However, in the Federalist Papers, you're not going to get the framers coming right out and saying, look, we're doing this because we don't trust the people. Nevertheless, there was an underlying element of that.
Let's go to John in St. Paul. John, welcome to Mid-Morning. Hi, John.
Yes. Can you hold for 1 second?
You know what, John? We'll come back to you in just a moment. It's really hard to hold on a talk show. Let's go to Philip in Litchfield. Philip, welcome to Mid-Morning.
Good morning.
Hi, Philip.
Hi. My question is could we take a vote and leave it up to the people whether we want a majority or electoral college?
Okay, Philip, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Professor, I'm going to reinterpret that question. How exactly do we get this done, and would we need a popular vote to determine if we're going to rely on the popular vote?
Well, as I say, the simple answer is no, that this is something in the Constitution, and it would require a constitutional amendment to get rid of it.
Well, but how do you know? I think a lot of people don't know how we get a constitutional amendment.
Okay, what has to happen is that it has to be proposed in the Congress and receive the two-thirds votes in both houses of Congress in order to be proposed. Or there's actually a second method that's rarely used, which is that two-thirds of all state legislatures can call for a constitutional convention to deal with that matter or any other matter. But even if you get the two-thirds majority of both the House and the Senate voting to either change or get rid of the Electoral College, then you would have to have the ratification votes of three-quarters of all of the states, which means something around the order of 13 states out of 50 could block it from going into effect.
Let's go to Tom in St. Paul. Tom, welcome to Mid-Morning.
Hello?
Hi, Tom.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment about an expression that's come up from time to time, which is the tyranny of the majority.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that there are a lot of mechanisms in the way our government was designed originally that are still in operation, and they're not designed, despite the desire for one vote, one person, one vote, to protect the views of the majority, but to protect the views of the minorities, where both geographical and other kinds of minorities, and that's what distinguishes our democracy from others around the world that do tend to be based more on one person, one vote.
Okay, thanks.
I think that's that comment is very much to the point. The idea of the framers really was to set up institutions of government that did protect minorities. That's certainly the case in the Bill of Rights, and it is the case in terms of minority votes in states. The fact that some states are relatively small but should still be allowed to have some level of power, that was the idea behind the Electoral College, and also the idea behind having each state have two U.S. senators regardless of population.
Now, David Lanoux, we're down to seconds. If you could just tell us, what do you think is going to happen to the Electoral College in the wake of this non-ending election?
I think probably nothing, because the ability to amend the Constitution is so difficult. Now, you may see a few states play with the idea of turning to the Maine and Nebraska system, but even that I expect to be fairly limited.
All right. David Lanoux, we've run out of time. I want to thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
David Lanoux is a professor and director of graduate studies in the Political Science Department at Texas Tech University in Lubbock, Texas. I'm Catherine Lanfrey. You're listening to Mid-Morning here on Minnesota Public Radio.
Today's programming is made possible in part by the Advocates of Minnesota Public Radio. Contributors include the McKnight Foundation, working to strengthen families and communities.
Support for NPR comes from Keen, helping clients transform the way they do business through Internet solutions, providing e-strategy, e-development, and e-management services. Keen, we get IT done.
I'm Catherine Lanfrey. I want to remind you, just a few minutes after 10, we'll be continuing Mid-Morning, and we'll be talking about how the media has performed in its coverage of the flip-flop election night and everything that's happened since then. Just a week ago today, we were asking you if the media coverage of the election was helping you make up your mind about who to vote for. Well, now that it's been quite the amazing week, tell us how the media performed for you again. All right, that's coming up on Mid-Morning. Then, of course,